His advice to students was to follow any simple diet which proved suited to one's constitution. Master ate little, often rice, colored with turmeric or juice of beets or spinach and lightly sprinkled with buffalo ghee or melted butter. Another day he might have lentil or chana inverted exclamation mark curry with vegetables. For dessert, mangoes or oranges with rice pudding, or jackfruit juice. Visitors appeared in the afternoons. A steady stream poured from the world into the hermitage of tranquility. Everyone found in Master an equal courtesy and kindness. To a man who has realized himself as a soul, not the body or the ego, the rest of humanity assumes a striking similarity of aspect. The impartiality of sense is rooted in wisdom. Masters have escaped Maya. Its alternating faces of intellect and idiocy no longer cast an influential glance. Sri Yukt's war showed no special consideration to those who happened to be powerful or accomplished, neither did he slight others for their poverty or illiteracy. He would listen respectfully to words of truth from a child, and openly ignore a conceited pundit. 8 o'clock was the supper hour, and sometimes found lingering guests. My guru would not excuse himself to eat alone, none left his ashram hungry or dissatisfied. Sri Yukt's war was never at a loss, never dismayed by unexpected visitors. Scanty food would merge a banquet under his resourceful direction. Yet he was economical, his modest funds went far. Be comfortable within your purse, he often said. Extravagance will buy you discomfort. Whether in the details of hermitage entertainment, or his building and repair work, or other practical concerns, Master manifested the originality of a creative spirit. Quiet evening hours often brought one of my guru's discourses, treasures against time. His every utterance was measured and chiseled by wisdom. A sublime self-assurance marked his mode of expression, it was unique. He spoke as none other in my experience ever spoke. His thoughts were weighed in a delicate balance of discrimination before he permitted them an outward garb. The essence of truth, all pervasive with even a physiological aspect, came from him like a fragrant exudation of the soul. I was conscious always that I was in the presence of a living manifestation of God. The weight of his divinity automatically bowed my head before him. If late guests detected that Sri Yukt's war was becoming engrossed with the infinite, he quickly engaged them in conversation. He was incapable of striking a pose, or of flaunting his inner withdrawal. Always one with the Lord, he needed no separate time for communion. A self-realized master has already left behind the stepping stone of meditation. The flower falls when the fruit appears. But saints often cling to spiritual forms for the encouragement of disciples. As midnight approached, my guru might fall into a doze with the naturalness of a child. There was no fuss about bedding. He often lay down, without even a pillow, on a narrow davenport which was the background for his customary tiger skin seat. A night-long philosophical discussion was not rare, any disciple could summon it by intensity of interest. I felt no tiredness then, no desire for sleep, Master's living words were sufficient. Oh, it is dawn. Let us walk by the Ganges. So ended many of my periods of nocturnal edification. My early months with Sri Yukt's war culminated in a useful lesson how to outwit a mosquito. At home my family always used protective curtains at night. I was dismayed to discover that in the Serampore hermitage this prudent custom was honored in the breach. Yet the insects were in full residency, I was bitten from head to foot. My guru took pity on me. Buy yourself a curtain, and also one for me. He laughed and added, if you buy only one, for yourself, all mosquitoes will concentrate on me. I was more than thankful to comply. Every night that I spent in Serampore, my guru would ask me to arrange the bedtime curtains. The mosquitoes one evening were especially virulent. But Master failed to issue his usual instructions. I listened nervously to the anticipatory hum of the insects. Getting into bed, I threw a propitiatory prayer in their general direction. A half hour later, I coughed pretentiously to attract my guru's attention. I thought I would go mad with the bites and especially the singing drone as the mosquitoes celebrated bloodthirsty rites. No responsive stir from master. I approached him cautiously. He was not breathing. This was my first observation of him in the yogic trance. It filled me with fright. His heart must have failed. I placed a mirror under his nose. No breath vapor appeared. To make doubly certain, for minutes I closed his mouth and nostrils with my fingers. His body was cold and motionless. In a daze, I turned toward the door to summon help. So, a budding experimentalist. My poor nose. Master's voice was shaky with laughter. Why don't you go to bed? Is the whole world going to change for you? Change yourself, be rid of the mosquito consciousness. Meekly I returned to my bed. Not one insect ventured near. I realized that my guru had previously agreed to the curtains only to please me. He had no fear of mosquitoes. His yogic power was such that he either could will them not to bite, or could escape to an inner invulnerability. He was giving me a demonstration, I thought. That is the yogic state I must strive to attain. A yogi must be able to pass into, and continue in, the superconsciousness, regardless of multitudinous distractions never absent from this earth. Whether in the buzz of insects or the pervasive glare of daylight, the testimony of the senses must be barred. Sound and sight come then indeed, but to worlds fairer than the banished Eden. The instructive mosquitoes served for another early lesson at the ashram. It was the gentle hour of dusk. My guru was matchlessly interpreting the ancient texts. At his feet, I was in perfect peace. A rude mosquito entered the idol and competed for my attention. As it dug a poisonous hypodermic needle into my thigh, I automatically raised an avenging hand. Reprieve from impending execution. An opportune memory came to me of one of Patanjali's yoga aphorisms that, on ahimsa, harmlessness. Why didn't you finish the job? Master. Do you advocate taking life? No. But the death blow already had been struck in your mind. I don't understand. Patanjali's meaning was the removal of desire to kill. Sri Yukteswar had found my mental processes an open book. This world is inconveniently arranged for a literal practice of ahimsa. Men may be compelled to exterminate harmful creatures. He is not under similar compulsion to feel anger or animosity. All forms of life have equal right to the air of Maya. The saint who uncovers the secret of creation will be in harmony with its countless bewildering expressions. All men may approach that understanding who curb the inner passion for destruction. Guruji, should one offer himself a sacrifice rather than kill a wild beast? No, man's body is precious. It has the highest evolutionary value because of unique brain and spinal centers. These enable the advanced devotee to fully grasp and express the loftiest aspects of divinity. No lower form is so equipped. It is true that one incurs the debt of a minor sin if he is forced to kill an animal or any living thing. But the Vedas teach that wanton loss of a human body is a serious transgression against the karmic law. I sighed in relief. Scriptural reinforcement of one's natural instincts is not always forthcoming. It so happened that I never saw Master at close quarters with a leopard or a tiger. But a deadly cobra once confronted him, only to be conquered by my guru's love. This variety of snake is much feared in India, where it causes more than 5,000 deaths annually. The dangerous encounter took place at Puri, where Sri Yukteswar had a second hermitage, charmingly situated near the Bay of Bengal. Prafula, a young disciple of later years, was with Master on this occasion. We were seated outdoors near the ashram, Prafula told me. A cobra appeared nearby, a 4-foot length of sheer terror. Its hood was angrily expanded as it raced toward us. My guru gave a welcoming chuckle, as though to a child. I was beside myself with consternation to see Master engage in a rhythmical clapping of hands. He was entertaining the dread visitor. I remain absolutely quiet, inwardly ejaculating what fervent prayers I could muster. The serpent, very close to my guru, was now motionless, seemingly magnetized by his caressing attitude. The frightful hood gradually contracted, the snake slithered between Master's feet and disappeared into the bushes. Why my guru would move his hands, and why the cobra would not strike them, were inexplicable to me then, Prafulla concluded. I have since come to realize that my divine master is beyond fear of hurt from any living creature. One afternoon during my early months at the ashram, found Sri Yukteswar's eyes fixed on me piercingly. You are too thin, Mukunda. His remark struck a sensitive point. That my sunken eyes and emaciated appearance were far from my liking was testified to by rows of tonics in my room at Calcutta. Nothing availed. Chronic dyspepsia had pursued me since childhood. My despair reached an occasional zenith when I asked myself if it were worthwhile to carry on this life with a body so unsound. Medicines have limitations, the creative life force has none. Believe that, you shall be well and strong. Sri Yukteswar's words aroused a conviction of personally applicable truth which no other healer and I had tried many exclamation mark had been able to summon within me. Day by day, behold, I waxed. 2 weeks after Master's hidden blessing, I had accumulated the invigorating weight which eluded me in the past. My persistent stomach ailments vanished with a lifelong permanency. On later occasions I witnessed my guru's instantaneous divine healings of persons suffering from ominous disease, tuberculosis, diabetes, epilepsy, or paralysis. Not one could have been more grateful for his cure than I was at sudden freedom from my cadaverous aspect. Years ago, I too was anxious to put on weight, Sri Yukteswar told me. During convalescence after a severe illness, I visited Lahiri Mahasaya in Benares. Sir, I have been very sick and lost many pounds. I see, Yukteswar, you made yourself unwell, and now, you think you are thin. This reply was far from the one I had expected. My guru, however, added encouragingly, let me see, I am sure you ought to feel better tomorrow. Taking his words as a gesture of secret healing toward my receptive mind, I was not surprised the next morning at a welcome accession of strength. I sought out my master and exclaimed exultingly, sir, I feel much better today. Indeed. Today you invigorate yourself. No, master. I protested. It was you who helped me. This is the first time in weeks that I have had any energy. Oh yes. Your malady has been quite serious. Your body is frail yet, who can say how it will be tomorrow? The thought of possible return of my weakness brought me a shudder of cold fear. The following morning I could hardly drag myself to Lahiri Mahasaya's home. Sir, I am ailing again. My guru's glance was quizzical. So, once more you indispose yourself. Gurudeva, I realize now that day by day you have been ridiculing me. My patience was exhausted. I don't understand why you disbelieve my truthful reports. Really, it has been your thoughts that have made you feel alternately weak and strong. My master looked at me affectionately. You have seen how your health has exactly followed your expectations. Thought is a force, even as electricity or gravitation. The human mind is a spark of the almighty consciousness of God. I could show you that whatever your powerful mind believes very intensely would instantly come to pass. Knowing that Lahiri Mahasaya never spoke idly, I addressed him with great awe and gratitude. Master, if I think I am well and have regained my former weight, shall that happen? It is so, even at this moment. My guru spoke gravely, his gaze concentrated on my eyes. Lo! I felt an increase not alone of strength but of weight. Lahiri Mahasaya retreated into silence. After a few hours at his feet, I returned to my mother's home, where I stayed during my visits to Benares. My son! What is the matter? Are you swelling with dropsy? Mother could hardly believe her eyes. My body was now of the same robust dimensions it had possessed before my illness. I weighed myself and found that in one day I had gained 50 pounds. They remained with me permanently. Friends and acquaintances who had seen my thin figure were aghast with wonderment. A number of them changed their mode of life and became disciples of Lahiri Mahasaya as a result of this miracle. My guru, awake in God, knew this world to be nothing but an objectivized dream of the Creator. because he was completely aware of his unity with the divine dreamer. Lahiri Mahasaya could materialize or dematerialize or make any change he wished in the cosmic vision. All creation is governed by law, Sri Yukt's walk included. The ones which manifest in the outer universe, discoverable by scientists, are called natural laws. But there are subtler laws ruling the realms of consciousness which can be known only through the inner science of yoga. The hidden spiritual planes also have their natural and lawful principles of operation. It is not the physical scientist but the fully self-realized master who comprehends the true nature of matter. Thus Christ was able to restore the servant's ear after it had been severed by one of the disciples. A. Sri Yukteswar was a peerless interpreter of the scriptures. Many of my happiest memories are centered in his discourses. But his jeweled thoughts were not cast into ashes of heedlessness or stupidity. One restless movement of my body, or my slight lapse into absent-mindedness, sufficed to put an abrupt period to Master's exposition. "You are not here," Master interrupted himself one afternoon with this disclosure. As usual, he was keeping track of my attention with a devastating immediacy. "Guruji," my tone was a protest. "I have not stirred, my eyelids have not moved, I can repeat each word you have uttered. Nevertheless you were not fully with me. Your objection forces me to remark that in your mental background you were creating three institutions. One was a sylvan retreat on a plain, another on a hilltop, a third by the ocean. Those vaguely formulated thoughts had indeed been present almost subconsciously." I glanced at him apologetically. "What can I do with such a master, who penetrates my random musings? You have given me that right. The subtle truths I am expounding cannot be grasped without your complete concentration. Unless necessary, I do not invade the seclusion of others' minds. Man has the natural privilege of roaming secretly among his thoughts. The unbidden Lord does not enter there, neither do I venture intrusion. You are ever welcome, Master. Your architectural dreams will materialize later. Now is the time for study." Thus incidentally my guru revealed in his simple way the coming of three great events in my life. Since early youth I had had enigmatic glimpses of three buildings, each in a different setting. In the exact sequence Sri Yukteswar had indicated, these visions took ultimate form. First came my founding of a boys' yoga school on Ranchi Plain, then my American headquarters on a Los Angeles hilltop, finally a hermitage in Southern California by the vast Pacific. Master never arrogantly asserted, "I prophesy that such and such an event shall occur." He would rather hint, "Don't you think it may happen?" But his simple speech hid Vatic power. There was no recanting, never did his slightly veiled words prove false. Sri Yukteswar was reserved and matter-of-fact in demeanor. There was naught of the vague or daft visionary about him. His feet were firm on the earth, his head in the haven of heaven. Practical people aroused his admiration. Saintliness is not dumbness. Divine perceptions are not incapacitating, he would say. The active expression of virtue gives rise to the keenest intelligence. In Master's life I fully discovered the cleavage between spiritual realism and the obscure mysticism that spuriously passes as a counterpart. My guru was reluctant to discuss the superphysical realms. His only marvelous aura was one of perfect simplicity. In conversation he avoided startling references, in action he was freely expressive. Others talked of miracles but could manifest nothing. Sri Yukteswar seldom mentioned the subtle laws but secretly operated them at will. A man of realization does not perform any miracle until he receives an inward sanction, Master explained. God does not wish the secrets of his creation revealed promiscuously. Also, every individual in the world has inalienable right to his free will. A saint will not encroach upon that independence. The silence habitual to Sri Yukteswar was caused by his deep perceptions of the infinite. No time remained for the interminable revelations that occupy the days of teachers without self-realization. In shallow men the fish of little thoughts cause much commotion. In oceanic minds the whales of inspiration make hardly a ruffle. This observation from the Hindu scriptures is not without discerning humor. Because of Mahaguru's unspectacular guise, only a few of his contemporaries recognized him as a superman. The popular adage, "He is a fool that cannot conceal his wisdom," could never be applied to Sri Yukteswar. Though born immortal like all others, Master had achieved identity with the ruler of time and space. In his life I perceived a godlike unity. He had not found any insuperable obstacle to mergence of human with divine. No such barrier exists, I came to understand, save in man's spiritual unadventurousness. I always thrilled at the touch of Sri Yukteswar's holy feet. Yogis teach that a disciple is spiritually magnetized by reverent contact with a master, a subtle current is generated. The devotee's undesirable habit mechanisms in the brain are often cauterized. The groove of his worldly tendencies beneficially disturbed. Momentarily at least he may find the secret veils of Maya lifting, and glimpse the reality of bliss. My whole body responded with a liberating glow whenever I knelt in the Indian fashion before my guru. Even when Lahiri Mahasaya was silent, Master told me, or when he conversed on other than strictly religious topics, I discovered that nonetheless he had transmitted to me ineffable knowledge. Sri Yukteswar affected me similarly. If I entered the hermitage in a worried or indifferent frame of mind, my attitude imperceptibly changed. A healing calm descended at mere sight of my guru. Every day with him was a new experience in joy, peace, and wisdom. Never did I find him deluded or intoxicated with greed or emotion or anger or any human attachment. The darkness of Maya is silently approaching. Let us hie homeward within. With these words at dusk, Master constantly reminded his disciples of their need for Kriya Yoga. A new student occasionally expressed doubts regarding his own worthiness to engage in yoga practice. "Forget the past," Sri Yukteswar would console him. "The vanished lives of all men are dark with many shames. Human conduct is ever unreliable until anchored in the divine. Everything in future will improve if you are making a spiritual effort now." Master always had young chelas in his hermitage. Their spiritual and intellectual education was his lifelong interest. Even shortly before he passed on, he accepted for training 2 6-year-old boys and 1 youth of 16. He directed their minds and lives with that careful discipline in which their word disciple is etymologically rooted. The ashram residents loved and revered their guru. A slight clap of his hands sufficed to bring them eagerly to his side. When his mood was silent and withdrawn, no one ventured to speak. When his laugh rang jovially, children looked upon him as their own. Master seldom asked others to render him a personal service, nor would he accept help from a student unless the willingness were sincere. My guru quietly washed his clothes if the disciples overlooked that privileged task. Sri Yukteswar wore the traditional ochre-colored swami robe. His laceless shoes, in accordance with yogi custom, were of tiger or deer skin. Master spoke fluent English, French, Hindi, and Bengali. His Sanskrit was fair. He patiently instructed his young disciples by certain shortcuts which he had ingeniously devised for the study of English and Sanskrit. Master was cautious of his body, while withholding solicitous attachment. The infinite, he pointed out, properly manifests through physical and mental soundness. He discountenanced any extremes. A disciple once started a long fast. My guru only laughed, "Why not throw the dog a bone?" Sri Yukteswar's health was excellent. I never saw him unwell. He permitted students to consult doctors if it seemed advisable. His purpose was to give respect to the worldly custom. Physicians must carry on their work of healing through God's laws as applied to matter. But he extolled the superiority of mental therapy, and often repeated, "Wisdom is the greatest cleanser. The body is a treacherous friend. Give it its due, no more," he said. "Pain and pleasure are transitory. Endure all dualities with calmness, while trying at the same time to remove their hold. Imagination is the door through which disease as well as healing enters. Disbelieve in the reality of sickness even when you are ill, an unrecognized visitor will flee." Master numbered many doctors among his disciples. Those who have ferreted out the physical laws can easily investigate the science of the soul, he told them. A subtle, spiritual mechanism is hidden just behind the bodily structure. Sri Yukteswar counseled his students to be living liaisons of Western and Eastern virtues. Himself an executive Occidental in outer habits, inwardly he was the spiritual Oriental. He praised the progressive, resourceful and hygienic habits of the West, and the religious ideals which give a centuried halo to the East. Discipline had not been unknown to me. At home father was strict, and too often severe. But Sri Yukteswar's training cannot be described as other than drastic. A perfectionist, my guru was hypercritical of his disciples, whether in matters of moment or in the subtle nuances of behavior. Good manners without sincerity are like a beautiful dead lady, he remarked on suitable occasion. Straightforwardness without civility is like a surgeon's knife, effective but unpleasant. Candor with courtesy is helpful and admirable. Master was apparently satisfied with my spiritual progress, for he seldom referred to it. In other matters my ears were no stranger's tree-proof. My chief offenses were absent-mindedness, intermittent indulgence in sad moods, non-observance of certain rules of etiquette, and occasional unmethodical ways. Observe how the activities of your father Bhagabhati are well organized and balanced in every way, my guru pointed out. The two disciples of Lahiri Mahasaya had met, soon after I began my pilgrimages to Serampore. Father and Sri Yukteswar admiringly evaluated the other's worth. Both had built an inner life of spiritual granite, insoluble against the ages. From transient teachers of my earlier life I had imbibed a few erroneous lessons. Akila, I was told, need not concern himself strenuously over worldly duties. When I had neglected or carelessly performed my tasks, I was not chastised. Human nature finds such instruction very easy of assimilation. Under master's unsparing rod, however, I soon recovered from the agreeable delusions of irresponsibility. Those who are too good for this world are adorning some other, Sri Yukteswar remarked. So long as you breathe the free air of earth, you are under obligation to render grateful service. He alone who has fully mastered the breathless state is freed from cosmic imperatives. I will not fail to let you know when you have attained the final perfection. My guru could never be bribed, even by love. He showed no leniency to anyone who, like myself, willingly offered to be his disciple. Whether Master and I were surrounded by his students or by strangers, or were alone together, he always spoke plainly and upbraided sharply. No trifling lapse into shallowness or inconsistency escaped his rebuke. This flattening treatment was hard to endure, but my resolve was to allow Sri Yukteswar to iron out each of my psychological kinks. As he labored at this titanic transformation, I shook many times under the weight of his disciplinary hammer. If you don't like my words, you are at liberty to leave at any time, Master assured me. I want nothing from you but your own improvement. Stay only if you feel benefited. For every humbling blow he dealt my vanity, for every tooth in my metaphorical jaw he knocked loose with stunning aim, I am grateful beyond any facility of expression. The hard core of human egotism is hardly to be dislodged except rudely. With its departure, the divine finds at last an unobstructed channel. In vain it seeks to percolate through flinty hearts of selfishness. Sri Yukteswar's wisdom was so penetrating that, heedless of remarks, he often replied to one's unspoken observation. What a person imagines he hears, and what the speaker has really implied, may be poles apart, he said. Try to feel the thoughts behind the confusion of men's verbiage. But divine insight is painful to worldly ears. Master was not popular with superficial students. The wise, always few in number, deeply revered him. I dare say Sri Yukteswar would have been the most sought-after guru in India had his words not been so candid and so censorious. I am hard on those who come for my training, he admitted to me. That is my way, take it or leave it. I will never compromise. But you will be much kinder to your disciples. That is your way. I try to purify only in the fires of severity, searing beyond the average toleration. The gentle approach of love is also transfiguring. The inflexible and the yielding methods are equally effective if applied with wisdom. You will go to foreign lands, where blunt assaults on the ego are not appreciated.